Welcome back to Crosstabs, the podcast about what polls are and what they are not, a show designed to help you understand how the tools that measure and shape public opinion are built and wielded. I'm your host, Farah Bostic. I'm a strategist, researcher, and founder of The Difference Engine. As I mentioned last time, we're doing a three-part series about some of the technical aspects of survey research, including public polling. We're looking at how the industry evolved from door-to-door, phone-to-phone contact using lists of real consenting people to a tech-enabled, programmatic advertising-influenced, multi-billion-dollar industry that, along the way, inadvertently built a pretty sizable risk surface area for fraudsters looking to infiltrate and exploit online surveys for financial gain. This kind of fraud carries real risks, not just for pollsters trying to predict elections or journalists trying to describe a changing electorate, but for anyone who relies on survey data to understand groups of people in business, marketing, government, academia, politics, journalism, and beyond. Today, I'm joined by Rich Ratcliffe, Chief Trust Officer at OpinionRoute, to talk about how we got to a place where online opt-in convenience sample carries enough risk that the Pew Research Center, as we heard in last episode's conversation with Andrew Mercer, has called it out for its tendency to produce skewed results because of what they call bogus respondents. In this conversation, you'll hear a brief history of how we find people to survey, from the days of double opt-in verified validated panels to the rise of online communities like e-rewards to the adoption of programmatic advertising methods, which led to innovations like blended sample, sample exchanges, online insights platforms, and to the advent of digital incentives, which brings us to the current day, when folks like Rich are sounding the alarm about the potential for fraud in online sample and offering advice on how to fight it.
My name is Rich Ratcliffe. I am the Chief Trust Officer for OpinionRoute. The Chief Trust Officer is actually a new role for me in terms of the title, but I've been doing this job for a little while. I've been in the industry for close to 30 years. I've been with OpinionRoute for 5 of those years. OpinionRoute is an online survey operations company. We blend technology and services into what we provide and what we bring to the table. A lot of what I am focused on is the data quality efforts that need to be involved in that. As I mentioned when I said I was a chief trust officer, that is the reason for that. That has everything to do with what we refer to as the trust bucket. That's compliance, privacy, confidentiality, all those things that all agencies want when they want any kind of operational technology to be a part of their world, as well as what they want in their own agency.
You have an interesting origin story that got you interested in this area of data quality and trust.
Yeah, it was a bit of an impactful moment. I was the president of Carbon View Research, and this was back in 2010, between 2010 and 2015. It was when online was really moving quite well. Double opt-in was probably on the backside of its growth, and programmatic was starting its process. We started a study, and it was on heart stents. We felt we were good in terms of feasibility. Lots of heart stent operations happen. It's actually an outpatient surgery now. It was $250,000 study, and fraud infiltrated so much that I got taken for $250,000. So that has a pretty significant impact on anyone's career when that stuff starts to happen. So in the short term, the first 90 days of that, I really thought about first making sure the client was taken care of. We went transparent as much as we basically laid it all out and showed them how it happened. It was a pre-post study, so they infiltrated the pre, which meant that the post was ruined in the process. And in doing so, we also found out that the sample companies are not really liable when these things happen like that. Their cap was at 10K. And that process really sort of impacted how I wanted to look at my career from that point forward. We were building software that really helped us. And I realized at that point that I really wanted to move the needle as it relates to data quality within the insights industry. Hmm. It took a little while for me to find the right sort of position in my life to be able to sort of go all in on that. It took about 3 or 4 years to sell Carbon Bee Research and move into a position that I could impact that situation. Hmm. It really has become sort of this, I would almost describe it as an OCD passion for data quality and everything around it. There's sort of two flips of that coin in that process. Very passionate about how we can help people understand this, but also how we can catch the people doing it. Mm-hmm. That process is sort of, it's not come full circle yet. We're not completely there as an industry. The idea of having me doing something like this doesn't mean that since I'm in it, it's going to get fixed. It does take an industry to make this work. But that's really how I got into this. So we've been able to do quite a bit to understand and unfold what data quality means within the industry.
So we were introduced through a mutual partner, in part because I was trying to get my head around two things. One was this, it got a bit of publicity when it first came out, this piece that the folks at Pew Research wrote about bogus respondents in different kinds of online surveys for political research. And so they were kind of comparing opt-in online panels, convenience sample, versus probability panels and voter file-based probabilistic sampling. And so as I was reading through their description of where they were seeing more cases of evident fraud, or as they put it, bogus respondents, I started to think, like, you know, how much of this is actual fraudsters? How much of this is organized? How much of this is just people trying to make a quick buck? How much of it is bots? All of that sort of thing. So I reached out to some people that turns out we knew in common for recommendations of someone who could walk me through what bogus respondents really means. Because I think while Pew was trying to describe the potential problem in polling, they were also very polite about it in the way that they described the problem, which is very Pew Research of them. But I think one of the things that has struck me in our conversations since that initial introduction, and obviously I have my own interest in it because we are seeing more fraudsters in qualitative research sample, and we are seeing more use of generative AI for responding to screener questions and those kinds of things. So it is also on my mind for my own practice. But as we've been having our kind of conversations up to today, I think one of the things that really struck me was, even though I have been working in market research now for about 20 years, the area of sample was just really something I only had a very cursory knowledge of. And I even, you know, worked at OTX when it was very proud of its sample program, right? And so in the interim, I think maybe it would be helpful to kind of take a step back and talk about the history of how we've found people to participate in surveys or market research, or for that matter, I mean, it's a little different on the polling side, but not that much different on the polling side. Maybe you can just sort of talk about where we were pre-2009 or 10.
Pre-2009-10, we were doing all double opt-in at that point. We had been through about a decade of double opt-in communities that were there specifically to host people who were interested in taking surveys.
So they had opted in to be in a recruiting panel, and then they had opted in to participate in the survey in question.
That's yes. What we mean, so they were opted into, that they were double opted into the recruitment, through the recruitment process to the community. Mm-hmm. And then from that community, they were then invited in email fashion to take surveys. Mm-hmm. That was really from, I would say, early 2000s. You can sort of mark it based on when the internet became an instrument that was representative of the population. There was a point where it was mainly an affluent moment for the internet. But when we hit penetration to a certain point that we could see representation in the population, even though it wasn't quite there, we knew that we could start doing double opt-in and that sort of thing. Now, back during that time, I built two different panels. We had over 100,000 people in those panels, and they did great. We didn't see the kinds of things that we see today. Panels really stayed around until about 2014. It was in that space that panels started in the sort of 2013, 2014 space, we started seeing blending happening. The blending of the multiple sourcing, the community, the double opt-ins, but then this term started showing up called river sample. And river sample was convenience sample. So it was really meant to solve a problem. And it did solve a problem. In many ways, was mentioned to be a downgrade from double opt-in and the ability to really balance the way you needed to balance with the five or even 10 demos. But convenience was a different approach, basically. And that blend started happening in that space. It was around 2016 that it hit mainstream. And it hit mainstream to the point that it sort of moved out of the back office of programmatic advertising. And we connected, as a market research industry, we connected to the programmatic digital advertising industry. Much larger, it's almost as if the David was connecting to the Goliath. We know how large that industry is today. And all that technology that is used is what we use today. That happened in 2015, 2016, somewhere in that space. And very quickly, there was a silent, almost separation of our industry. That separation was sample industry, and their nomenclature changed. Everything they talked about changed. They were talking about impressions and clicks and everything that you would talk about in the advertising space. Meanwhile, the market research agencies were talking about completes and reconciliations and length of interview and all the things that you talk about for research. And this went on for the next, well, until now. It still happens to where we have people still asking, how's the response rate? There isn't a response rate in our space. In 2020, programmatic pretty much took over. There was no double opt-in communities that you could really go to and say, fulfill my study completely. And even today, there's really not a way that you can go to a double opt-in community and feel as if you can get your normal-sized study completely fulfilled by that double opt-in community and the way that you need to balance the way you need to. As with anything, innovation brings advancement, but what it does is it sometimes leaves behind a bit of an Achilles heel that we have to deal with. Programmatic brings a lot of problems. It brought a lot of feasibility, but it brings a lot of problems. In today's 2024 world, by 2025, programmatic advertising is looking at a $100 billion fraud problem. That massively eclipses our industry in so many ways that we have to now deal with that because we are connected to them. And that is the programmatic space that we are working with. And that's hopefully the history that helps you understand that space.
There's a lot that's interesting about that history, because as we've been talking, it's one of these things where you'll say something and it's so plain as day, and also something that I sort of ambiently knew but hadn't put the pieces together on. So I'm aware of intercepting people in mobile games, for example, and saying like, hey, if you want to keep playing this game for free, take this quick survey, and that this is a method for finding people to take surveys. But honestly, I think kind of my understanding of like online sample providers probably in any depth, you know, stopped in the e-rewards era, right? When it was sort of these loyalty programs where, you know, if you want to get a few more points on your loyalty program that you can redeem for a $5 off at Old Navy or something like that, then take this survey. And I think this evolution to programmatic is interesting for a couple of reasons. And one is just, you know, if you work in the field of advertising, you are keenly aware of how much fraud there is in programmatic. It's not really stopping anyone from spending there. But at the same time, very few, you know, big reputable brands are doing all of their ad buying in a programmatic fashion. They're still going to upfronts and new fronts and making contextual ad buys and doing some amount of their spend in a traditional way. But it seems like the entire kind of industry of research flipped. And there's not a lot of those kinds of traditional methods of getting samples still in place. Again, I see it in Qual, where some of our recruiting partners we don't work with anymore because I know they're using basically ads on Facebook to find people. And that means I get really bad show rates, or people who just don't qualify for my studies, or people who seem to qualify on the screener, but then you get them in a conversation and it's obviously bad. So I don't even work with them anymore. But it's different for quantitative projects where you're trying to get 500 people who have a stent and can talk about it, you know, or whatever sort of particular sample you're trying to look for that's not so hyper-specific, or that is extremely specific. I mean, that is one of the things that I feel like has happened over the years, is our ability to say yes to extremely low incidence types of consumers because of these new sort of sample sources. What drove the complete flip? Is it just the kind of drive to the bottom on price? Is it that, frankly, like to your point about research companies still talking about response rates when response rates aren't really a thing, because we can always keep pinging programmatic platforms in order to find somebody who will opt into the survey? What's driving the we're not paying attention to this part of the business, I guess, on the kind of research agency side in general? I mean, obviously there are people who do and care about it quite a bit, but is it just the price? Is there something else going on?
Well, it wasn't just the price. The price was a downstream impact off of convenient sampling becoming part of the mass. You think about what it costs for a programmatic advertiser to purchase clicks or to sell clicks. It's super cheap. That is, like, in our world, we're talking fractions of a cent. So recruitment, when you think about it, recruitment went from dollars to cents very quickly. But what started it was the fact that the double opt-in business model within market research was not a profitable model. It had big issues to it when it went from the idea of the e-rewards, which was really one of the first of the double opt-ins, where there was this list and they just needed to convert the list. In many ways, we should take a lesson from that. That list had a primary subject that we attached ourselves to. When we drove the process and flipped it over to our primary reason for being in touch with you and creating this community is market research, it downscaled the attractiveness to the process. So then it gets into, with double opt-in, the attrition rates and all the business model metrics around making that a profitable model. Lots of money was lost, lots of money was gained. If you knew how to do it right, you could make money on it, but you surely weren't going to make the kind of money that you wanted to make as either a private equity situation or a company that just wanted to be a passionate entrepreneur to serve respondents and to serve. Right. So the business model impact then caused a lot of things to start happening. The next thing that contributed to that was just outright feasibility. In a double opt-in space, the amount of money you have to spend to bring one person in caused a significant supply-demand issue to start happening. Now, most supply-demand issues start finding their way by the price for which you pay for that thing that's in demand. What happened in our world is that we basically burnt the respondents. We exhausted them. We gave them significant amounts of, quote, opportunities to take surveys, to the point that they were getting bombarded with 50, 60, even 100 invites in one day to take surveys. We all know who takes surveys and who doesn't. And it was really, like, the amount of surveys that were in an invitation to the younger male group, as an example, because they don't take a lot of surveys and that's not their sort of secondary or even third interest in that idea. They were shown the exit door in many ways because it was just too much. What also happened was that the survey designs started changing. And it was because, if you think about it, if we've got the person, let's ask the person. So it became these kitchen sink surveys that had everything in them. They had ANU plus a concept test plus a usage, and all this stuff just sort of blended into 30, 45 minute surveys. So
right. Why only ask one matrix question when you can ask six or seven of them? Why not also do a concept test with a highlighter? I mean, we have the technology. let's ask every kind of question.
We're all in 2D. We're not looking at doing rotation by check marks now. The King world, where we're able to do this right. So there was this overflow effect that happened off of the business model not working. That was really the main issue. It was a great idea. eRewards had an amazing idea with it. It expanded the market. It brought technology in. It brought online forward. It did everything it was supposed to do. Now, what happened between then and now is that there was another innovation that happened that was absolutely needed, and that was the exchange model. And it was the idea that you've got a lot of people, a lot of small samples, and if we put them all together and we then serve that out into a buy-sell platform, which was becoming all the rage, then we can absolutely solve some of these problems. And they absolutely did. They absolutely did. It was an amazing innovation. And we're in this space of the exchange space. Now, the life cycle of exchanges is coming into question in this process because of what we're seeing in sort of the ripple effect of what happens with exchanges in the first place. Because exchanges are essentially a store for programmatic sample. Right. You can go to any of these brands. You can select and not select. And if you decide you want the cheapest, you can just go to the cheapest. If you want premium, you can get some premium there. The price points across the board. There are, I have to say that what I've started to see now is an influence of premium samples make their way into the mix. So we're seeing almost a reverse life cycle start to happen, to where they're blending premium and double opt-in into the mix much more to try to get back to something that they feel good about in that process. So how did sample get so far separated from the market research agency? In many ways, if you think about what research agencies do, they don't think about that kind of technology. That's not me, just serve the participants. I'll design my survey. I'll design my research. You make sure you get respondents to me. I'll make sure I provide good research. And then I'll make sure that I provide the analysis that I need to. So if you notice, research agencies were looking that way, and sample companies were doing a lot over here, over in a completely different space. And it was super technically adapted. So that idea is not something that researchers really wanted to be involved in. They just knew that they were able to get their research done quickly.
Right.
And the convenience, pun intended, the convenience of having sample come in at such a quick rate, at such a cheap rate in the process, meant that we weren't looking at what the hangover was going to look like at the end of all of it, right? So market research agencies for a very long time talked about response rates, and they talked about, what's the balance of your panel, and all the things that were double opt-in when double opt-in had left the building. It just wasn't there any longer. And that is the separation that started to happen in this process. It started showing up in the conferences. You started seeing almost the high school click process happen, where sample companies are over here and the researchers are over here. And we have started to see that the only way that a lot of this can get fixed is when all of it blends together in a global data quality approach. Because this is not something that just the U.S. went after. This is global, right? This is programmatic is global. It's not something U.S. thought of. So it's because of that that they went on and did their thing and made money and provided a product participant, and the market research agencies purchased it. It wasn't a matter of someone being ignorant. It was a matter of them focusing on the product and service that they have, which is research. Yeah. Focusing on the product they have, which is sample. So it just became almost two separate industries.
It's an interesting parallel to the ad business more generally, where one of my early advertising agency jobs was at TBWA, Chiat Day, when the media discipline was in-house to Chiat Day. That was not a separate company that was doing media buying and strategy. We were a full service agency. We did all of it. And then, you know, Omnicom and its infinite wisdom decided to spin that out as a separate entity for a lot of seemingly very good reasons, right? Like they could work with clients that did not have a creative agency relationship inside the Omnicom network and therefore capture some spend that they weren't going to get on the creative side. They could get it on the media side. But it drives a whole bunch of other kind of challenges, which is, you know, creative ideas are entirely dependent on which kinds of channels you can place them into. Like coming up right. with a great idea for TV when there's no TV budget and no TV strategy exactly. is a waste of everyone's time and effort. It also means that the media agencies are pitching their own creative ideas. And I think to some degree, OTX is an interesting model like that, where it really starts out as a research tech company. It's like, we can field online surveys testing video. Like that's ultimately the origin story of OTX. And then they're like, ooh, we can, you know, aggregate and sell sample on an exchange. And like all of these kinds of technology first lines of business and ways to make incremental money that no one else was making. And oh, and then we can layer services on top of it. Like we can also have some researchers here, right? But like when I was at Holland Partners, our primary sample provider was OTX. And we did so much business with them that our free bagels on Fridays were actually not free. They were paid for by Shelley. Like she's the one who sent them over to us, which I didn't know until much later. I think, you know, in the ad business, you wind up now having creatives and brand strategists who frankly don't know that much about how media works these days and don't really know that much about like the mechanics of buying advertising or how programmatic even works. And yet their ideas are going to get placed over there. And those right. of us working in like the research services agencies are like, I have a great idea for a survey or an experiment or whatever. And I don't need to worry too much about the how, because they tell me they can do it. And it's very interesting to think about that. It's also interesting to think about the timing of it, which feels like everything else that was going on with the internet, all of these new companies coming in with cheaper, faster ways of doing things. I think simultaneously, you also have more self-service tools, companies like SurveyMonkey launching in the, what was that, like 2000, 2001, that were like, anybody can do a survey now. And it's like, well, yeah, sort of. But I think The interesting thing about those progressions is they start to feel like, they feel really recursive. Like if we go from having high quality but expensive to maintain and hard to maintain double opt-ins to online panels where it starts to feel a little bit easier, a little bit less expensive to find people. And hey, since I've got you, it's still expensive enough. I want to ask you everything I can think of to ask you. And then it's like, okay, but now you've taxed that sample panel and now we're doing River and programmatic and all of this other stuff, but we've kept the bad habit of asking too many questions in too complicated of ways. I mean, we're still how many years into the mobile revolution having to like really pause and think about question types we want to put into surveys because they just don't work very well in mobile. Right. It's the silly season of political polling. And so I get pushed surveys for local races out here in Suffolk County all the time. And I can tell that these are not great research companies because they are impossible to take on mobile. They are just the most miserable experiences on the planet. Lots of matrices. And it's just like, what are you doing?
Yeah, sliding and benching. A lot of sliding and benching. That's all you could, no pinching. That's the one thing that you shouldn't have to pinch.
No. And like forcing scroll, you know, shifting to landscape mode to be able to see all the way across. Yeah, it's not good. But like, it's just fascinating by keeping these disciplines separate. It means one side doesn't have to think that much about what the other side is doing. And it's just kind of keep chugging along until something bad happens.
Bad things have happened. So
yeah, let's start talking about that.
Go look at the top five objectives and missions to the top five market research companies in the world. What you will notice is that they don't talk about research respondents. They don't talk about participation. They don't talk in that language. Mm-hmm. In fact, they have the same exact language with measurement mm-hmm. that advertising companies have, like the whole advertising space, because yep. that's where they are pulling what they're doing. So just that's a good exercise for people to go through to understand what's happening with research today, where it's going. The other part to mention is there's a term that's been here for, I think it's been about 5 years, and it was around ResTech, mm-hmm. research technology. And there's a ResTech landscape map that's been built that helps people understand who does what within the technology of research. It's a significantly busy, very large map and getting larger by the day. The other part to this is what you talked about with SurveyMonkey. And it was as soon as that started happening, there was this sort of this quaking that happened in the industry around, oh, there's this thing that's going to take all of our work. We have those things happen every 3 to 5 years where they're mm-hmm. just significantly quaking. Right now, it's the AI quake, and it's a big one, no doubt. But the SurveyMonkey process and the DIY process was one. Anyone that's been in this industry pretty long, one of the things they get paid to do is to see around the corner and to see what's going to happen with that thing that is being put in front of them. It was as if I could see 100 miles down the road when I saw the SurveyMonkey. I knew that there would be a bunch of players to rush to the DIY engines. Google got involved. Mm-hmm. They bought their Google surveys. They offered it for free, like they offer everything else for free. So that they can get our data mm-hmm. and do with it what they want, right? So that process, I knew what would happen is it wouldn't necessarily raise the water level or cause any significant issues, because professional researchers, for the most part, knew that those engines were not going to be able to handle what they needed done in research. But if you understand technology, it doesn't stop. In fact, it mm-hmm. moves at Moore's Law pace. Moore's Law pace, for people who don't know it by now, is 8 months to 12. Knowing that, I knew that what would happen is that we would start to see all cookie cutter research. I'm going to call it cookie cutter. I don't mean to offend people, but it's the same instrument like a concept test where you want to understand, do they like it, do they not? You need a directional on what's going on. You need it fast. And that sort of cookie cutter research was going to get taken by DIY. Mm-hmm. It took a few years, but because all those survey instruments just made their way onto mm-hmm. these platforms, and the Insights platform started to come out of that. I knew as soon as I saw SurveyMonkey, Insights platforms are in our future. And it took, I would say, about, again, 5 to 7 years before we started seeing Insights platforms pop out. Mm-hmm. The Insights platforms allow for API connection to Lucid. And from that, all their philosophical research methodologies within that process, and then automatic reports at the end. What none of them really addressed very well is what happens when you get fraud? What happens when data quality hits the basement on your survey because your survey made it to Reddit, or it made it to a dark website, or it made it to a place where you're now infiltrated completely. And there is no step in those situations where the research that the results are showing, that it's saying this is not good, right? Mm-hmm. They don't like the product, or they like the product, or they love the product, and 98% love the product. Well, there's a reason why 98% love the product, because they're not human. Mm-hmm. But there was a point where there was sort of the Insights platform of the week. Right. It's like every research agency out there that had the money to take their methodology and put it onto a platform, they did it. Mm-hmm. And I'm pretty sure that some of them still love to do that. And we're fine. That's how you want to produce your product. Mm-hmm. If it works and you have people that want to buy it, I'm all for it, because it creates value in that way. What I'm starting to see in today's world, outside of the fraud issues that are a dark alley that no one wants to go into, is that there is sort of the new generation coming through. And one of the things you talked about is, are we coming back to the place where the business model still won't work? And that's not the case. That's really not the case, Farrah. We have a lot of smart people in this industry, and it's been more than 10 years since we walked from double opt-in. And in the world of innovation and tech, we should be able to figure out a way to make a business model work where we've got validated sample that we can understand who that person is, understand where they live, and do all of that within the boundaries of, as an example, GDPR or any kind of privacy laws that need to be out there. I heard someone say the other day, well, we're trying to fight fraud, and every time we get somewhere with it, another privacy law comes out and keeps us from understanding what's going on with that device. And there is some truth to that.
Yeah.
But the issue really is that we can't forego privacy on a personal nature because we want surveys to be completed. We need to make sure the privacy stays there, and we have to make sure that we protect their interest as much as create an interest on our side to our products and services that we want within the space. Hmm. We also have to do it in a way that's attractive to the people who want to take surveys, or to the people, I'm not going to say to the people who want to take surveys, but to the general population. Mm-hmm. Now, that sort of segues into an area around how I sort of found my next moment within data quality. And knowing that I wanted to go there, I mentioned to someone that I felt like I'm going to chase this data quality issue as far as I can. And I can guarantee that when I get to somewhere near the head of the stake, I'm going to see organized crime. I'm going to see things that I shouldn't. I have to be really careful about being near or involved in. And that's exactly what started to happen.
After the break, we'll hear how people around the world are exploiting online sample and survey methods for personal gain, and how there is no single source of fraud, but a network of fraudulent activities and fraudsters that are interconnected and require a whole-of-industry approach to combat. Hi, it's just me. I wanted to take a quick break in this conversation to let you know that I'm not just a podcaster who can't get enough of the technical details of polling. I'm also the founder of a research and strategy consultancy focused on helping leaders get real about their customers and decide to grow. We combine qualitative and quantitative research built on high-quality data, brand marketing, and product-led go-to-market strategy with an eye on the latest in behavioral and marketing science to help brands make big decisions. If you're interested in what we do, you can always get in touch with me at www.thedifferenceengine.co. I hope to hear from you.
I chased it all the way to the fraud interviews that I put out 2 years ago. That gave me enough information to sort of take it to another level, which I'm doing right now. Just a teaser in that space, we have a lot of information on how the fraudster community has coalesced and created their own little cottage industry. Mm-hmm. They have their own software. So knowing that, we have to be really careful about what we're getting involved in here. The more I started researching the U.S., the more I figured out that the U.S. thinks that survey fraud is the market research space committing fraud on the person taking the survey, not the other way around.
Right.
And they do because of the information that they think that we are taking from them, that we are doing something with, you know, reading something on their computer or getting too much information from them, or not keeping what is called personal information private, which is not the case. So if you're a respondent, you somehow have found this podcast, please know we want to protect you. Mm-hmm. We want to give you a good experience, and we want more of you to take surveys. The last point on this is what's happening with the newer generations. I do a podcast on, well, I am part of a podcast. That is a better way to put it. Great people that do this podcast. I don't actually do it myself. I helped produce it. I helped start it. And it's around diversity, equity, and inclusion. Called DEI Matters. There is a interview out there for Gen Z. Mm. That's the reason I mentioned it. The Gen Z nation and the alphas behind them don't look at this space quite the same way. They look at everything around DEI, everything around their leisure, everything around professional, everything around their life as just one bucket. They don't segment that stuff. I mention that because there's a lot of models that are starting to play through. Theirs is one of them where they just allow for a connection point with a community of Gen Zers that, oh, by the way, take some surveys. So it becomes this activity that's blended into their life. And it's much more what it needs to be. I remember back in the day, there was a spark of that, and it still is there, when Protégé came up. And Protégé, they are absolutely a large player in our space. They thought it would be a good idea to take their main business model and say, oh, by the way, take some surveys. And that created a vibrancy in their research and the participant feedback that just wasn't there beforehand. I really felt as if they had struck a good balance in this process, as opposed to this one line of connection that we are putting all of you in a place because all of you like to take surveys. That's not exactly what we need to think about here. The business model moving forward needs to be this, oh, by the way, as opposed to take my surveys or leave.
That's a really interesting kind of observation about this whole thing, which is the feeling that from the later days of the dominance of things like e-rewards to where we are now, there's only one reason to be in this quote unquote community. And so that's not a community. But I would say that your observation about the community piece, the sense that we all have a reason to be here other than taking surveys. And so taking surveys is this incidental way to be part of the community as opposed to the primary driver of it's extremely interesting. I think the other thing that surprised me, and you told me this before, but in the US, when you ask people about survey fraud, they feel that it's the surveyor defrauding the respondent, not the respondent defrauding the surveyor. And that is so wrapped up in the kind of feeling of bad faith, I think, that a lot of people have about everything online, everything that requires any kind of data collection. And we certainly see that in our work, the amount of kind of reassuring we have to do with people that they will remain anonymous, that their name and likeness and contact information will not be shared, that this is not for sales purposes. And even then, you know, one of the things we've started to see over years now is, you know, 2009, 2010, we started doing a lot of video diaries. And people loved doing them. And they especially loved it when you turned on the social features, because a lot of the early digital diary platforms were set up to be basically like Facebook. So you'd complete your questions and upload your video. And once you were done, you could see everybody else's responses. People loved it. Now, no one wants that. No one wants to interact with other people's content. They don't want their content to be seen by anyone other than the researchers. Frequently, we have problems with connecting them back to the screen, because when they log into the diary platform, they use a completely different email address or something. And it's just because they're trying to keep everything separate to keep their privacy intact. And we wind up having to do a lot more work in order to confirm that they're really supposed to be there. It's a really interesting sort of break of the social contract.
That gets back to the exchanges. So this all networks in so many ways, but it gets back to the exchange. Because when the exchange came out, in general, it was the idea that this is available. Do you qualify? I don't. Okay, done. This one's available. Do you qualify? Done. Routing played a role in this. Routing, again, great innovation at the moment. It had an amazing focus to it in terms of what it did. And it solved the problem. It really did. When you think about it, it solved the peppering of 50 invites in your inbox or 50 opportunities on your offer wall or your portal that you go to for your community by doing the pretty simple thing of inviting you to a survey. But if you don't qualify for that survey, going ahead and putting you in another survey to see if you qualify for it. Great aspirational thinking going on there. Terms of just making the participant experience good. But what happens when the person can't get out of it? They don't get paid to answer 14 gender questions and 14 age questions before they get into a survey. But we've gotten wildly out of control in that space. And it's something that we need to prove to the participants that we can come back to a space that makes it convenient for them, as well as allows us to do what we need to do. So the other part that's playing a role in our feasibility world and our supply and demand, this crazy thing is this convenient sampling process is now what we're starting to see are some cracks in that seam for feasibility. The reason we're seeing that is a lot of reasons. One of the main reasons is currency inequality. You go to the U.S. dollar, which is one of the most powerful currencies in the world. The dollar for us, which it can't buy much at any store, is literally an hour's pay in a lot of developing countries. And it is no coincidence that those developing countries are the hot spots for market research for all. Because if they make $10 in the day, that could be their day's wage. And they could do that all day long, every day. And they do absolutely do that. There's training videos for it. There's software for it. And there's people that will help them learn how to do that. And they don't think it's bad. They don't understand what's so bad about this thing they call a social security number. I know if I've got this thing, I can then assume that person's identity. And I can move from that. I know some people just their mouths dropped on that idea, but we saw that on the fraud interview, how they were doing that. So because of this currency inequality and the fact that we went to digital and we're not sending postal incentive any longer, which is incredibly old school and it should stay where it lives, which is old school. It needs to stay there, but we do need to figure a way out to validate our incentivization in a way that it either matches the currency in the country they're in, or it makes sure that the person who is getting that incentive, the incentivization program can't do this, but we need to make sure that the person getting it isn't doing a proxy. So you are sitting in Bangladesh, you can make it look like you're coming out in Kansas.
Right.
And in that process, that's how fraud is really driven towards a commerce space. It really is just playing itself out in that space. So when we look at this idea of participant experience, do we really think an authentic survey participant wants to sit for 15 minutes unpaid to then take a survey that's going to give them 50 cents for 20 minutes of their time? We just need to logically look at what we're doing to our space and what we're really doing to our inventory. So the only people that will sit there all day long and do it are the people who they want that dollar because it's an hour's wage. They want that $10 because it's a day's wage. So when we are catering to that process, it's kind of hard for us to then say, well, how do we attract folks in the country we want them to be in to take surveys authentically? That then networks back to the community issues.
I mean, this is so interesting how interconnected all of it is, that the respondent experience, I remember the pitch for Blended Sample at OTX. The idea was, well, we wouldn't waste the respondent's time and we wouldn't waste the opportunity to fill a survey with someone who had responded to the initial email or the initial touch. And so you'd answer a few questions and, well, okay, you don't qualify for study A, but looks like you do qualify for study B. We'll take you through a couple more screening questions. I remember even the kind of platonic ideal of that was that the screener question from study A would kind of carry over into study B. You wouldn't be asked the gender and age question again if you'd already been asked it. It would just travel with you to the next one. And instead, what's happening is people are being asked their age and gender and race seven times before they find out whether, well, before they either give up or they finally qualify for something. And I think there are two things that wind up being really interesting about that. And one is just if you're creating the conditions where the actual people you're looking for get discouraged essentially by the experience and opt out, like just give up, close the window, move on, then you create an opening for somebody else who does see an advantage in it. And I mean, this is just the case of any kind of arbitrage, right? And so that is the space that gets created by these bad experiences. I think the other thing you told me when we were preparing for this that just, again, was like, yes, I know that, and also had not thought about it in that frame, is the currency inequality component of switching to digital incentives. It's funny that you talk about the kind of old school incentives. I just got the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Agency or something, through Gallup, sent in the mail a survey to my home, and inside of the envelope was $2.
What?
And I'm like, I have to tell you, I got so excited. I was this close to making like a survey unboxing video or something about it. Like, this is what surveys used to be like all the time. But like, that experience is not what's happening now. Now what we're doing is giving you gift cards, or we're direct depositing digitally into people's bank accounts. And so this creates a lot of incentives. We see it in qualitative. I think I told you we had a study recently where we had someone who, I actually believe her that she was shopping this category. She just wasn't doing it in the US. And that's where we wanted her to be doing it. She was in the UK.
Okay.
And it was just like, partly I understand why. We pay better incentive rates in the US than in the UK for qualitative research participation. The US is actually one of the, I don't know if I should say this, but the US is actually one of the kind of most generous incentive places for qualitative research. It's one of the things that after talking to you, I'm like, a little bit terrified of, because $5, you know, we'll pay you 50 plus for qualitative research. And if you speak good enough English, you might make it through and have a good enough kind of story that you want to stick to. The other thing that's interesting about it is, I think the kind of word has gotten out because of social tools and tools like YouTube. I mean, after looking at the, and I'll link to those videos that you posted of your interviews with these survey hackers, because they're fascinating. But once you watch those videos, you're going to start seeing the videos teaching you how to complete a survey, which I had genuinely not come across before. But it's fascinating on multiple levels. One is, you've created this opening, you've helped people figure out how to hack it in order to do it. And then because they're teaching each other how to qualify for surveys and how to complete them successfully and how to get paid and either fully complete them fraudulently or other more nefarious means, which we'll get to. I think one of the interesting things that I had been initially skeptical about in Pew's report, one of the things they found was there was more evident fraudulent responding in two demographic groups. One was 18 to 24 year olds, and the other was, I want to say, Hispanic respondents or Hispanic males particularly. And they were speculating that part of the reason for this is those are two notoriously hard to recruit groups. And I also thought, like, well, you might want to start, you know, we don't typically in the age bracket question randomize the age brackets. And so 18 to 24 comes first. So if you're just speeding through, you'll pick the first one. And then on the question about Hispanic, that's a yes, no question. So you'll pick a yes and then move on. Like, there are all kinds of things there that are interesting. But I think now that I have seen those videos, I'm a little more persuaded, certainly a lot more persuaded, that the word has gotten out amongst these fraudsters that these are valuable demographics that are hard for us to traditionally find. You might even make more on incentives because we'll boost the incentive for 18 to 24 year olds because we know we can't find them. And all of those things are just collapsing in on each other to create this problem. And then we add going to a lot of effort. And I remember like thinking about when you were describing all of the steps involved, there's an old Dennis Leary joke about whether or not marijuana is a gateway drug to other harder drugs. And he says, it doesn't lead to, you know, shooting heroin. It leads to carpentry. Like, you start building elaborate bongs and apparatuses for consuming marijuana. And this feels like that. It feels like the little extra cash, if I'm smart and I set up a system for it and I can kind of automate it, then I can make a day's wages in a few hours at most. Then it leads to carpentry. I start doing things like getting a fake social security number, setting up a fake bank account, like doing all of these extra steps in order to have this survey responding as either a full-time job or a side hustle. And it's just, I honestly had not put all of those pieces together before. And I think even from the times we've talked before, I hadn't put together the part about we're creating this giant gap of the people we're actually trying to reach not wanting to interact with us because the experience is bad. in the screen. The experience is bad once you get into it. The incentives are not commensurate with the effort. And to your point about the currency inequality, a dollar, $5 just doesn't go very far. Why would I spend this much effort on something when the $5 doesn't make a difference?
Yeah, there's such a difference with seeing a dollar on a digital screen versus getting that dollar like you did. Like you let me ask, did you take the survey?
I haven't yet. It's sitting right here. It just came the other day. They did send me a follow-up postcard, like almost immediately, which was very interesting. But I will say, the second I saw the two $1 bills in this envelope, I felt an obligation to fill it out.
Right. But you wouldn't feel an obligation if the intro was, we're going to give you a dollar for this, right? Mm-hmm. And it's going to go into your bank account, right? The digital process tends to throw that into a more common space that doesn't excite you as much. And that incentive did exactly what it was supposed to do. I think it would be good to introduce, because we're in the middle of a paper for this, is a concept around what types of fraud and data threats are out there, data quality threats are out there. So I'll just speak to the concept and a short definition of each one. And that in many ways will allow us to sort of pivot at that point to what that means in our world today, because we need to identify structuring ourselves in a way that allow us to understand the threat. But there's also this idea of just identifying what is involved in today. Can we categorize it? Researchers like to segment and categorize everything. We like to put things in buckets. We like to make sure that things are nice and clean and that we've got a good analytic approach to it in the process. So this paper, it was written with three professors at Suffolk University in Boston. They are involved in the marketing education departments in that university. And specifically, I was working with Elizabeth Winters. She's the one that sort of started that process, and then she brought in two other professors. And we worked up a construct called FAIR. And FAIR, F-A-I-R, was meant to allow us to put these people and these threats into buckets, because it's not just people. I always talk about everything that I do, that if you've got a problem, there's an imbalance of people, process, and technology. Finding a solution to that problem is balancing the people, process, and technology that fits for purpose. We always talk about research needs to be fit for purpose. So the fit for purpose in this case is FAIR. F is for fictitious representation. So that is exactly what you're talking about with the person assuming the idea of a Hispanic or a low-age person. That's assuming also multiple survey participant identities. So as the Bengali person that I interviewed, he had six unnetworked mobile devices sitting, and below each one of them, he had a profile of who he needed to be when he answered surveys on that device. So in one of them, he was a mom with two children. In another, he was an 18 to 24-year-old male, which he got that right because that's what he was, but he was in, he was in Bangladesh. The next is automation. Now, when we think of automation, I think the word that immediately pops to everybody's head is bots. Okay, so let's just sort of kill the myth. Bots don't happen quite the same way they used to. They may find a rise and a spike based on AI, but bots aren't quite what we used to think they were. We can't look at that as a synonymous automation approach to survey completion. What really happens these days is more along the lines of when you go and you want to purchase something and all your information automatically populates on that form fill, you can form fill surveys in the same way. You can automate that process in a way that's a little bit more intelligent in the process as well. But what's crazy about automation is that we then look upstream some of the things we talked about. The data quality threat in this case is the programmatic sampling process. That's automated. It is the routing that's happening. So those are threats to us in this process. They did give us feasibility, but they brought quality down in the process. There was a scaling process that wasn't right. The next is I, and the I is irresponsible participation. So irresponsible participation is the idea of just straight up poor performance. Let's just call it out. It's inauthentic performance. We all know it, pattern responding, speeding. It's the old school category in all of these, right? Like even paper surveys were pattern responded. So we can look at that and say, that's probably the one we know the most is because people just are inauthentic. That's how they get reconciled out of a survey.
Right. And that's the one where SurveyMonkey has onboard tools to detect some of those things like speedsters, straight lining. And it's very funny because it's exactly the sort of standardized test advice you got as a kid where if you didn't know the answer, just pick B, right? So that's, I think, the thing that a lot of people imagine is that stuff. And we've kind of had tools in place for a long time to fight those. Although interestingly, Pew said that they saw as much fraud in people who took too long to respond as in people who took too little time to respond.
Yeah, that's a great point. One of the things to keep in mind about survey fraudsters is that they don't do this stuff for speed. If you think about what they're doing it for, they want to do it so that they don't get reconciled. Because they're there for the money. They're not there to just do the exercise and try to do quantity over quality. We've learned over the years, and they've learned over the years, that they have to do it for quality. It's an odd dynamic that happens that they are thinking
about.
They have
to do a good job of lying.
They have to do a good job. What a good job means to them is that they don't take surveys in the middle of the night any longer. They used to. They used to take surveys when they were awake. Now what they do is they stay up and take surveys when we are awake. They want to hide in plain sight. That means that they don't want to find edge moments in what they say. They don't want to have an open end that is a bad open end, as an example. They still are copying and pasting. And that's absolutely there. They're also doing Gen AI and that stuff. But that's one of the moments that we need to think about is that, yeah, it may be fraud when a person is inauthentic because they're racing through it and they're doing this and doing that. But think about the experience they just had trying to get into the survey in the first place. They just may be exhausted. So that's poor performance. So that's still a data quality threat. So when we think about fraud in what it is, everything around the idea of fraud, you're trying to hide an illegal act. that's really what it's about, right? And that's the reason why I wanted to interview them, because they were myths before we found them, right? Everybody was like, "That they're just ghosts." So we can't see. We're just seeing their post-fact. We're not seeing them. We're not seeing who they are. We're not seeing that they've got lives, right? The Bangladesh guy was a physics student in his third year. And oddly enough, he thought he was doing good because he was teaching people how to do surveys. But he was actually teaching them instead of just taking their money and running, because there was a lot of people in Bangladesh taking their money and running. So he thought he was serving a good purpose by taking their money and giving them classes on how to do this. The last one is response manipulation. That's where you get into a little bit more of a technology person. And in the middle of all of this is, I wouldn't call it new. Anyone that's been in this space is definitely knows what we're talking about with link jumping. So where does link jumping happen when you're talking about response manipulation? Because there is no response. What they're actually doing is saying, "I completed," without ever taking the survey. And that process is, it is attaching itself to something you said earlier. And that's around one of the things that's happened when we split off like we did, going full circle back to what happened. How did the sample industry get here, get where it's at, when the market research agencies didn't really see it? The impact from that is that we have a fragmented process. People own what they do, but they don't own the cycle. No one owns the full cycle. Even if you are an insights platform, you don't own the cycle. You own that one little area, but that's it. You don't own the cycle. So what happens in this process is that when A sends participant to a survey, all they're looking for coming back is the completion and the status of that survey. So participants have learned that. That was the second fraudster. He said in the last 12 months that he did this, that's what he knew. He was getting into some serious crime because he was getting survey links. He had 25 virtual devices, and he would immediately go to every device and click the survey link to then figure out the jump for it and then just put in the survey completion link. Because if you look at the link, you can fragment that out.
and
put the completion where you need to put it and move on. One of the things that happened in IA Nationals Atlanta was that every time I heard Melanie get up on the stage, she said, make sure you've got secure survey end links every time, because it's such a simple thing to do that solves so many problems in our world, in the sample world especially. It doesn't hurt the market research agency. It will start hurting them because the sample companies are now starting to say, well, if you don't come back to us and say that you didn't have 4,000 completes, you really only had 800, we're going to do something about that. We're going to charge you. If we tell you you took 4,000 completes, you cannot go a month and then dispute it. There's a time frame that they're doing that. So they're holding agencies responsible when it's really their issue. All they have to do is host survey end links.
Yeah, it's the kind of model of, like, I don't know, ordering food online and having it delivered to you. And if you don't right away take a picture of the fact that you ordered a, it's going to be a specific example because it happened to me a couple weeks ago, was like, I placed an order to pick up a bagel. It was an everything bagel. I got there, I picked up the bagel, I walked out across the street, opened it up. It wasn't an everything bagel. At that point, honestly, who cares? But I still, like, took a picture and sent it back to Uber Eats or whoever it was, saying like, hey, I ordered an everything bagel. I got a plain bagel. And like, but you know, in those circumstances that if you don't complain right away, nothing is going to happen. And they require you to take a picture of it and, you know, all of that sort of thing. But it is wild to think that you've paid for 4,000 completes and you've got to be the one to check that they really are there, because right, you've been given a data table that has 4,000 rows in it.
Right.
It's usually more than 4,000 rows, if that's what you asked for,
well, that,
right?
Well, that's the thing, is that the researcher isn't given a data table with 4,000 rows. They're given their data set that's got 800 respondents in it. The sample company has 4,000 people that took the survey. They don't.
Yeah.
They have 3,200 people that jumped. And that's the issue here. So because of that,
This, I have to say, like, one of the things in my background is that I went to law school, and I just don't understand why the big buyers of research are not just redlining these terms and saying, you cannot give me 3,200 null sets. Like, that is not a thing I have to catch. That's a thing you have to catch.
You cannot charge me for something that is not even in my landscape. Like, I can't even see it. Like, I didn't see the person come in. I don't have a record of them anywhere. And you want to charge for them because that's the project that it's on. And that's what's happening in this space. So when we get to the idea of response manipulation and link jumping being the most modern way of that, we then have some of the less modern ways. They're opening up their development console and looking at your code to see what answer they need to give so that they don't terminate on your screener, which then overlaps with irresponsible participation. It also overlaps in automation because you can then look at the JavaScript and understand what the JavaScript is doing. So JavaScript can only run if you allow it to run on your device. You can stop that from running.
Yeah.
So there's a lot of things you can do that hit every one of these all at once.
Mm-hmm.
And that's one of the things that when we were thinking about this structure, it's like, we can't look at this structure and think that there's some clean buckets here. There's a lot of things that happen together. And a lot of these things contribute to the others. These reasons are all networked in some way or another. They're usually not as networked as this. There's usually some clean approach and linear approach to saying, why did this happen upstream? The word upstream implies linear, right? So when you think in those terms, the networking, the neural network of the data quality threat is really significant in what we've done. Now, there's a lot of good things that are happening in our world in this space, but we have to talk about the threats so that we can flush them in some way, shape, or form.
Crosstabs is hosted by me, Farah Bostic, production by The Difference Engine, and edited by me. Music from Audio Jungle by S Audio. Find us at crosstabspodcast.com, where you can subscribe to our weekly newsletter and find out immediately when new episodes drop. Tell your friends about the show, subscribe on your favorite podcast service, drop us a note if you have any questions about poll design or sampling or weighting or anything else, and we'll see you next time.